It is Sunday morning, the 10th of November, at the City Tabernacle Baptist Church in Brisbane, and our pastor, the Reverend Paul Harrison, is commencing a new series of messages on contemporary ethical issues. Today's message is on abortion.
Said Job, and let us at the beginning of our worship say it with him. Your hands shaped and made me, O Lord. Remember that you moulded me like clay, clothed me with skin and flesh, and knit me together with bones and sinews. Turn with me to the Word of God in Scripture. We'll read first that marvellous psalm, at least the first 18 verses of it. Psalm 139. How near is God? O Lord, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest when I sit down and when I rise up. Thou discernest my thoughts from afar. Thou searchest out my path and my lying down, and art acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. Thou dost beset me behind and before, and layest thy hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high, I cannot attain it. Whither shall I go from thy spirit? Or whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend to heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in Sheol, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there thy hand shall lead me and thy right hand shall hold me. If I say, let only darkness cover me and the light about me be night, even the darkness is not dark to thee. The night is bright as the day. For darkness is as light with thee. For thou didst form my inward parts, thou didst knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise thee, for thou art fearful and wonderful. Wonderful are thy works. Thou knowest me right well. My frame was not hidden from thee when I was being made in secret, intricately wrought in the depths of the earth. Thy eyes beheld my unformed substance. In thy book were written every one of them the days that were formed for me when as yet there was none of them. How precious to me are thy thoughts, O God! How vast is the sum of them! If I would count them, they are more than the sand. When I awake, I am still with thee. I want to read just two verses from the first chapter of Jeremiah. They are verses about the preciousness of an individual life, and say first of all that before that life is formed in the womb, God knows it before the embryo is formed.
set number 2, Dr. Ivor Thomas speaking at the Greenslopes Baptist Church on the 5th of July.
Doctor, we'll possibly speak for about 30 minutes on this occasion and then leave plenty of time for you to raise your questions or to make some comments. I wonder whether we can just pause for a moment here and ask God to be with us in this session. Let's all just stand for one moment. Father, once again we come before you now and consecrate this session to your glory. We are people in the ministry of Jesus Christ, seeking to fulfill our ministry as you would have us do it. We have many areas, Father, which we confess we are not sure of, and we seek and search for answers. We pray that you will be pleased to be with us just now, that some glimmer of light may appear in areas that seem so confusing and complex to us. Grant us further light, Father, as we do further thinking and give further consideration to this subject, and we pray that we may discover those basic biblical principles on which we must build our thinking and doctrine. Be with us now and be with the speaker, and we ask it through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Thank you.
We've been dealing this morning mainly with problems of conception. I want to spend a few minutes only on this problem of pregnancy, and then we'll be moving on to the problems of contraception. And that brings us, first of all, to abortion. And again, while I have material prepared, I suggest that in the interest of time and to allow time for questions, I'll abbreviate that. If you would like to raise the matter of abortion in the discussions, that will be okay, except to just give a few little outlines. The widespread nature of abortion, the Royal Commission on Human Relationships set up by the Whitlam government, and which included the Archbishop from Brisbane here, estimated that there were over 60,000 abortions annually performed in Australia. Others think it's more like 100,000, so that overall throughout Australia it's probably about one abortion for every 3 to 4 births. A half of these occur in single women, a third are in married, and a sixth are in those who are divorced or separated or widowed. But the significant thing to me is that at least a third of those are in women under the age of 20. What should our attitude be? And again, I would suggest that there are a number of principles. First of all, there is the authority of the scriptures. But the second thing is, we see that the scriptures are silent on this particular issue. And therefore, in the absence of any specific text on this issue, it's a matter of weighing up principles. And so immediately we get into that situation of where it's a matter of weighing up biblical principles. Different people, looking at the same situation, will give different weights to different principles and may come to different conclusions in specific instances. However, there is clearly outlined the principle of the sanctity of human life, and there are all sorts of references for that, Zechariah 12:1, Ezekiel 18:4, and so on. There's clear evidence of divine interest in the fetus, Psalm 139, verses 13 to 16, beautiful passage that is. I love Job too. Job chapter 10, verses 8 to 12. Often I use that passage just at the beginning of a day to get into that attitude of worship, because encapsulated in a few verses are just the majesty of God and his concern for human beings, even before they're born. However, the scriptures do not necessarily equate a fetus with a living person. And as far as I'm aware, there's only one reference to abortion in the scriptures, and that's in Exodus 21:22. I'm aware that there's some difficulties with the Hebrew text there, and this sort of thing may come out in the discussion later on, if someone wants to take up the matter of abortion. I would suggest that there are biblical grounds for taking life, that thou shalt not kill, of Exodus 20, verse 13, is followed by a series of commands that they were to kill people, the command to kill those who break certain laws, Exodus 21, 12, 15, 16, 17. We find that life was forfeited in the New Testament, Ananias and Sapphira, and even genocide itself was occasionally commanded, 1 Samuel 15. That there is the principle that God calls us to obedience and love, and therefore, it sometimes comes down to the matter of a choice of the lesser evil. That abortion, to me, it seems, is evil in any situation. But sometimes, so sinful and complex and ambiguous are the circumstances that people get themselves into that it's no longer a case of choosing between right and wrong. No matter what one does, it's going to be wrong. And I think that you pastors dealing with people in irregular marital situations within the churches, as you're starting to have to come into grips with this, will empathise with me there, that it's no longer a matter of sorting out right from wrong in that strictly legal sense. Therefore, it may be a matter of choosing the lesser of the two evils. I myself regard abortion as reprehensible, as evil in itself, but sometimes the lesser of two evils, in the same way that capital punishment of a criminal substitutes the principle of sanctity of human life with the principle of the necessity of the community. And likewise, killing in a just war perhaps overrides the value of the individual human life. For example, was it right for Christian British soldiers to be shooting Christian Argentinian soldiers over the Falkland Islands issue? We've got that same sort of thing applies in the abortion situation. I mention that because in the obstetric world, we do have now the antenatal diagnosis of fetal abnormality. There are now over 40 inherited diseases, metabolic and chromosomal, which can be identified by drawing off amniotic fluid. And, of course, the big one is mongolism or Down syndrome, which is more likely to occur when the mother is older, over the age of 38, or when she has a past history of giving birth to a Mongol. There are other diseases, too, sex-linked muscular dystrophies, where the child, as it grows up, develops extreme muscular weakness and then eventually perhaps dies in the teenage years. The main problem is whether abortion of a fetus shown to have a serious or lethal defect is justified. At least that's how it seems to me that is the main problem. For example, if we take the problem of maternal rubella in pregnancy, if a woman in that first 6 to 8 weeks contracts German measles, there's a very high chance of about 60% that baby will have major congenital defects. It'll be either blind or deaf, or both, as well as have a congenital heart disease, and probably have mental retardation as well. And in this, the obstetrician's quite vulnerable. There is, in the American literature, the case of a doctor who was sued for refusing to carry out an abortion on a woman who had rubella and who later had a deformed child. And the ground of the legal action was wrongful life, believe it or not. There are arguments in favour of abortion, and in fact some Christian colleagues of mine do feel that it is right to abort the woman when it's known that she has a baby with a major congenital defect. There's a matter of the suffering that the child is going to go through, the suffering for the mother, for the family, the cost to the community. For example, it's estimated that the institutional services will cost something like $100,000 for the mongoloid child. Or, likewise, greater cost for the child with a neural tube defect, where it will need many operations. However, it seems to me that the same principles apply to this as for abortion. And so we have to ask ourselves, is there any point in undertaking antenatal diagnosis of fetal abnormality? Now, my own approach is that I explain to the patient, first of all, that there's little point in going ahead and having this amniocentesis done unless she's determined to have an abortion if it's found that the baby is abnormal, because there are risks associated with it. There's a risk of about a 1% chance of losing the fetus. The second thing I explain to the women is that under Queensland law, the presence of a handicap is not enough legally to do the abortion with. Now, I mentioned earlier on that one of the private doctors had rung me to say that he'd got an amniocentesis back and there was a chromosomal defect. And he asked what would be my attitude if he admits her. And I've said that we play it straight down the line. We had all the controversy when in 1981, on May the 18th, the abortion legislation was thrown out. We're still left with the Act of the 1860s, and clearly abortion is legal only if it's done to preserve the woman's life. And so I've told him that I'm prepared to approve that, provided there are two medical opinions in writing stating that medically they are doing this to preserve the woman's life. Now, some of them find no problem with this, that they just go through a series of mental gymnastics and say that the knowledge of knowing that she's carrying an abnormal child and facing up to all the consequences of that in the future are such that her life is at risk from mental disease or suicide and such like. Perhaps it's plain ostrich, but I take the attitude of the tax man, and that is assume that people are acting in good faith and with honesty, and unless it's glaringly obvious, I accept that those doctors who write that it's necessary to preserve the life of a woman are in fact stating what they believe to be the truth. It would be very difficult to prove to the contrary, which was the whole reason why the amendments to the abortion legislation were first of all proposed in 1981 of last year. The third thing that I explain to the patient is that I personally almost certainly will not be prepared to perform the abortion. But if she still wants it, and I think it's medically appropriate, I'll go ahead and do it. And I myself have been faced with the problem where a woman has been found to have an abnormality. But so far, I have elected the ones that have been under my personal care have elected to go on with the pregnancy at that stage. However, it does cause people to think more deeply of the issues. And this is sometimes the sort of thing that it seems to me a pastor may be asked about by someone in his congregation. Each case presents its own particular situation. What would the Lord do in this situation is the question I ask myself in this. And strangely, I suppose I tend to be legalistic, straight down the line, black and white, and to imagine that the Lord is sitting on the third chair in a consultation room, if it has not altered the decision that I come to, has certainly made a difference in the attitude I have when dealing with these sort of problems. I don't want to spend too much time on these, but as we're looking at the contemporary situation, we do have problems with contraception difficulties. The first one I've put up there is sterilisation, because again, it seems to me, looking at it from the point of view of Christian parishioners, a lot of Christians, whereas they're prepared to accept the pill or other reversible methods of contraception, have very real qualms when it comes to sterilisation. And the reasons for their qualms are, first of all, the finality of the procedure. Secondly, they're aware of emotional consequences. Perhaps sex desire may drop off. Some people feel that there are ethical problems, that it could open up the way to extramarital sex without fear of an unwanted pregnancy. But also it seems to me that some of the lay folk do find a problem from the religious point of view because sterilization is causing damage to the normal anatomy and physiology. It is true that there is temporary regret in sterilization. Various theories show the temporary regret varies between 0 and 27%. Permanent regret occurs in about 0 to 2% of cases, and the ones we watch out for are the ones where the marriage is shaky. The woman who's got about three children, and dad's on the drink, and life is getting difficult, and they feel that they just can't cope if another child should come along in that situation. And in an effort to save the marriage, could we please sterilize her so that she can work harder to keep the marriage going? They're the ones that we're very wary of, and I personally will not accept those, because we know that that's the group where we have the highest rate of regrets and requests for reversal of the procedure later on, when there is eventually a divorce, and a couple of years later, or several years later, the woman remarries and wants to start a new family. And the second one I've learned to be wary of is where the woman comes along and says, look, we've got four children, we're struggling. If we had another child, we'd have to build another room on the house and we'd have trouble getting the finance. We're still paying off the present house. And again, I won't take those on economic grounds, because they're a potent source of regret later on, because dad might get a promotion at work. He becomes the foreman, and in 8 or 9 years' time, they find that they are able to cope. They've gone a long way to paying off the house, and the woman wishes then that she had the ability to have another child. There is a problem from the Christian point of view with the sterilization in Queensland, and that is, again, we are still over under the old laws of the 1860 criminal code sterilization would fit into. And a sterilization must be of substantial benefit to the patient. The mere desire to avoid the responsibility of parenthood does not suffice, because it's outside the law. And here's where I have had difficulties, even with Christian couples who've come along. They said, look, we've got three children, we don't want any more. And we're sure that that's the right thing. And rather than face 20 years of being on the pill now, we'd like to have it over and done with. And one can see with them, and personally, I would agree with them. But I'm not prepared to accept them, because the doctor has to sign that in his opinion, there is a medical reason which makes further pregnancies of risk to the mother's life or health. And if someone's 27 years old, has got three healthy children, no history of serious illnesses in the past, I myself feel I can't sign that. And so we've got a tension between refusing to accept someone when we think that they may have reasonable grounds, because we're not prepared to certify in the way that the law or the statutes require. And so sometimes the mere fact that someone's coming to a Christian gynecologist means that they're less likely to be accepted for their sterilization, while he may be in sympathy with them. The intrauterine contraceptive device raises a number of difficulties. We don't really know how that works. There are a number of different theories, and there are probably a number of different actions. The big question is it an abortifacient? Now, it probably works by causing a white cell infiltration in the lining of the uterus so that the fertilized ovum fails to implant. And you can see the problem. Previously, contraception before fertilization was clearly different from abortion, which was after fertilization. And that was accepted generally until the IUCD came along, the intrauterine contraceptive device. The action of the contraceptive device seems to straddle that line that divides contraception from abortion. And in fact, the line itself now seems wide and blurred. A working party of the British Council of Churches stated that conception is not complete until the egg has implanted. But are they right? On the other hand, who's to say that they're wrong? And that brings us to the question of, when does ensoulment occur? Now, if a person says that ensoulment occurs at the time of fertilisation, they've got to face a number of objections. And the first one is in vitro fertilisation. Are they creating little souls in that petri dish? The second thing is twinning, where identical twins occur. We do know that it can be quite some time after fertilisation that developing cell mass actually splits into two cell masses. Does that mean that the soul has split into two and those identical twins are really the same soul running around in two bodies? A third problem that the person who says that ensoulment occurs at the time of fertilisation has to face is this, that it's now known that at least 50% and probably more like 60% of all human embryos abort spontaneously, and that the woman doesn't even realise that she's pregnant. Her period may have come a day or two later, and in fact what she's having is an early abortion. It isn't until more sophisticated methods of testing have come along that we've become aware of this situation. Now, if ensoulment has occurred at the time of fertilisation, does that mean that the majority of humans in heaven are going to be unrecognisable as such, never having completed organogenesis? That there'll be that the majority of the population in heaven will be these early miscarriages that have never been... And you can see the sort of difficulty... Now, R.F.R. Gardner, in a later publication, adopts the approach of looking at the human being, and again at this business of life support systems at the end of life. Now, we know that the body and the person do not necessarily cease to exist at the same time. You know, sometimes a person's brain is dead for days before the life support system that keeps their heart going is switched off. And even then, when the person is dead, their body remains round for some time. And even parts of that body are capable of continuing to grow, such as we take kidney transplants out of someone. And if the undertaker is especially skilled in his embalming, he can keep that body in existence for a long time. There is cellular activity still going on, and it has been stated somewhere that if conditions are right, say in the grave, someone who's been buried, that the temperature is right and such like there, that the fingernails can continue growing for as long as 2 months after death. Now, I don't know the pathological basis of that, where they got their material from to do that series, but can you see the point that they're making? Now, therefore, there may be no reason to demand that the body and the person, the human personality, start at the same time. And Gardner comes up with a number of propositions, and two of them I'm going to put to you because I think they're very germane. His first proposition is that any attempt to build Christian ethical principles on reproductive physiology is vain and ought to be abandoned. And obviously the physiology is changing all the time, so if we got our theology right one time, 10 years later, it can be hopelessly out of date. The second thing is that where only a post-conceptual method of birth control is available, we can and should employ it. And working as a missionary in Africa, I could see that one of the big problems there was oversize of families, where half the children failed to survive beyond the age of five, where people were living on a subsistence level or just below. And when a woman had 8 children, she'd lost quite a few of them, an added one coming along puts the rest into jeopardy. And I myself use IUCDs, and certainly as a Christian missionary taught midwives to use IUCDs, and I felt that it was theological hair splitting in that situation, that life or death situation, to go raising some of these principles. However, we come to the post-coital pill, and this to me is more of a problem. We do know now that if a young girl, say, has been out one night and makes a mistake and has intercourse, she goes further than she intended. If within 72 hours she takes 2 contraceptive pills, 2 tablets, 12 hours apart, the failure rate, or the conception rate, in other words, is less than 1%, and that's been done on a large series. And so, for the non-Christian, this is a very good backup for that girl who does make a mistake one night and is suddenly faced the next morning with, oh dear, am I for it or not? By that British Council of Churches definition that I gave before, the post-coital pill could be within the realm of contraception rather than abortion. And we get faced with this sort of problem. I was called one Sunday morning to say that two mental or girls who were under psychiatric care alleged that they'd been raped, and pregnancy in that situation would have rather dire consequences, and I was asked, would I please advise on post-coital contraception? How does the Christian respond to that situation? Menstrual regulation and... here, it seems to me, by menstrual regulation, I mean that if the woman is at risk of pregnancy and her period may be 5 days or a week late, she goes along and has a little curette just to clean out the inside of the uterus to bring on the period and also dislodge any very early pregnancy that may be there. To me, this seems to be getting more into the abortion sphere. But again, we've got problems, and I myself have been faced with this, of a woman with a family who was raped by a black man, was brought in by the rape squad, with whom we have a liaison at the hospital, because some weeks later the woman was going to pieces psychologically. Her period was overdue, and she had fear that she could be pregnant. What does the Christian do in that situation? Or the 13-year-old girl who's been brought along, having been raped, and it's been a genuine case of rape because the man has been caught and there will be a court case to follow. If her period goes beyond when it is due, what should the Christian advise in that sort of situation? Now, can you see, again, I'm sort of keep wanting to come back to this point, is that our theological principles, what we draw from the scriptures, has to be able to stand up in the day-by-day world, because that's the sort of world we're in. We come to contraception and the single girl as the last thing I want to talk about. And in the past, there have been five possible attitudes to providing contraception for the single girl. And I know that this has exercised ministers in the past. I know of one minister, in fact, he told me that he used to ask the girls when they were coming along to be married, have you been on the pill? And if they said yes, he was not prepared to marry them in the church. So that obviously this sort of thing has come up in one way or the other. One attitude is broadly permissive. Another one is to be neutralist, which of course is largely illusory. And we all, of course, realise that in a Rogerian, non-directive, so-called style of counselling, values are still being communicated from one person to the person being counselled. There's the attitude of reluctant sanction that says, look, she's going to get the pills anyway, so I might as well give them to her and avoid further problems. It's been pointed out that if one is reluctant or defers and then grants the request, it vitiates whatever positive value that initial reluctance might have had for that girl. Then there's the attitude of uncompromising refusal, and this has been the traditional Christian attitude. And again, the verse would be quoted, abstain from every appearance of evil. I've got a colleague, a Christian, who's been out in a one-doctor town, far, quite isolated, and this was the attitude that he adopted and had to face a fair amount of resentment in the community because there was no alternative choice for those people. And it was being pointed out, well, what right has he got to go and disadvantage us in this way, that we can't get this sort of treatment when we're short of moving and travelling a fair distance to the next town? The final position is that of the situationist. And again, I don't want to say much about here this, except that the situationists would apply the principle of agape, or love, as the sole criterion. And he's got a sort of a shifting standard, because he accommodates to whatever the situation happens to be. What's your attitude What would you advise if a mother comes along to you and says, look, I'm dreadfully concerned about my 17-year-old daughter. She's going through that rebellious stage, and I'm frightened that she's at risk of, that she's going to be pregnant. She's prepared to come along to the doctor with me, but I've got worries. What should I do? I don't know whether you get that sort of question. I can tell you we get them at the hospital. Can I suggest that if we're to make the decision in the real world, we need to bear in mind a number of things. First of all, the years of adolescence are lengthening. In 1900, the average age for the onset of periods or the menarche was 17. By 1968, it had dropped to 12 and a half years, and probably amongst Australian girls, we're not completely sure, probably it's about 11 and a half years. No. On the other hand, while they are maturing at an earlier biological age, because of educational and economic pressures, there's a longer length of time before they can embark on a marriage safely. The second point I want to make is what came out of that Commission's report on human relationships, that there is a level of teenage sexuality which cannot be ignored. A study in 1977 done amongst Melbourne University students, or teaching in the education department, I think, showed that 66% of the males under the age of 20 had had intercourse, and 56% of the girls had had. And this is the sort of situation that our young women are in these days. A study was done amongst high school students in Sydney in that same year, 1977, and it was found, taking those in the age group 15 to 16, that 47% of the children had had intercourse by that age of 15 to 16. And we do well to be aware that this is the school situation that these people are in. The third thing we need to realise is that it would seem that there is a 40% pregnancy rate in Australian girls by the time they have reached the age of 20. And of them, 7 to 8 out of every 100 will have had an illegitimate child. 5 will have married. And of course we know from other data the high incidence of marital breakdown in these young people who marry, particularly when there is a pregnancy involved. 20 of them or more will have had an abortion. So that probably 1 in 8 of our Australian girls will have had an abortion by the age of 20. Those are figures that have been calculated from the Family Planning Association clinic by Dr. Susan Hepburn in Sydney that I'm quoting. The fourth thing that I think we need to be aware of is that sociological data tends to indicate that availability of contraception is not associated with increased promiscuity. And in the past, I would have felt that if I go giving the pill to this girl, I'm going to put temptation in her way, and there's a greater risk of her becoming promiscuous. But now, as the data comes out, that does not seem to be the case. I myself work in a place where there's a high incidence of single girls getting pregnant, and I find that many of them who've got pregnant, in fact probably the majority, have been on the pill but have deliberately stopped months or even 12 months before. So that it would appear both ways that the level of promiscuity is not associated with the availability of the pill. And then the fifth thing that I think we ought to be aware of is that by the time someone is concerned about contraception, either the girl or her mother, that the chances are very high that sexual activity is already taking place. And again, a study was done, and this has been repeated in a number of different places, in the USA, where 14 to 18 year old girls were studied, and it was found that 83% of those who came along requesting advice about contraception had already been engaging in intercourse unprotectedly for 12 months or more by the time they come. Now, what do I do? The clinic that I work in sees mainly these single girls when they've had a baby, and we're seeing them at the postnatal clinic, or they've had an abortion and have come along for a checkup after that. If it's a young girl She doesn't fit into those categories, or even sometimes if she does, I myself speak to her about the dangers of permissiveness and the way it has opened up to speak to these people about God's laws and why they're there and why they're important. And sometimes these girls are receptive. My own position has changed from that of uncompromising refusal to reluctant sanction in the light of those studies. Which brings me now to just the final things. With these dilemmas that we face, how can we find the right path? There are passages of Scripture that I love which indicate that wisdom and guidance is available to us. James 1:5, if any of you lack wisdom, so on. Lovely, isn't it? Proverbs 3, trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not unto your own understanding in all your ways, and so on. So that the Bible does promise us wisdom and guidance. Second thing the Bible promises us is the ability to keep us. We have provided for us the ability to keep us from making false steps. 1 Thessalonians 3:3, the Lord is faithful, who will establish you and keep you from evil. And then one that I love from the Old Testament, I think it might have been in one of Mr. Sinfield's sermons as a teenager that I saw this verse, and it's really stuck in my mind since. And thine ears shall hear a word behind thee, saying, this is the way, walk ye in it. And just 2 weeks ago, I was involved with one of these situations, and we seemed to be going down just a line and about to come to a decision when there was that little voice. And again, the truth of those words seemed to be, thine ears shall hear a word behind thee, saying, this is the way, walk ye in it, when ye turn to the right hand or the left. And we were able to retrieve the situation and went straight down the line. I was about to compromise seriously one of my own principles just by being carried along in the sheer pressures of that particular situation. But the third thing is that when we do go astray and make the wrong decision, we are promised forgiveness and redirection. 1 John 1 verse 9. In these dilemmas we face borderline situations where there are shifting moral standards, and often the circumstances are such that either way will be wrong. I mentioned at the beginning that that day was a bit out of the ordinary. It wasn't because of the problems, but it was because in each of those situations that I mentioned, the way opened up to speak to the patient about the Lord. The first one, the 20-year-old girl, was moved to tears as we spoke to her about those things. And in fact, we invited her to come along to our church services in the local church because she happened to live in that district, but as far as I'm aware, she has not come. The 35-year-old divorcee, as I spoke with her, answering chords seemed to be struck in her. She remembered back to earlier days, Sunday school or something, I've forgotten the details now, that she realised she'd gone so far from. The 24-year-old single girl who came for contraception went without her contraception, went out rather thoughtfully. But again, in the interest of honesty, I must point this out. I suppose that subsequently I learned out that she did get pregnant, did have an abortion, and I saw her later on when she came back after the abortion. In these situations, again, I think from the point of view of day by day walking in them, Micah chapter 6, verse 8, perhaps sets out what one's attitude should be. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice, it says, and to do the right thing comes first. Once we know what the right thing is, I believe we are called to an uncompromising position. To know what the right thing is the difficult thing often. But it says, but to do justice and to love kindness. There needs to be a balance in showing mercy and not just a harsh legalism when we're confronted with these situations. Now, we do face dilemmas. The very definition of the word dilemma means that it's a position where one is left with a choice only between evils, or a choice of alternatives, neither of which is satisfactory, so that we are going to do the wrong thing of necessity in that particular situation. And that's why I love the last bit of this. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love mercy? And then, as we stand in the need of forgiveness, as we face these situations day by day, to walk humbly with thy God.
Thank you, Doctor. We're just going to open it now for a time of question. If you have a question, raise your hand, sing out nice and clearly, and the Doctor will do his best to answer the question for you. Yes, Doctor.
Well, that's a little bit of a difficult one. Yes, it usually means that I've got a very high sperm count. It may be of the order of 200 million per mil, with a total count of, say, either 500 million, and they know that when that sperm is used on women, that they conceive within a cycle or two. Well, that's interesting. The question was, has it got anything to do with his being a university professor or something like that? People have looked at this, and they there was a tendency at first to use people like that who are in a higher socioeconomic group, but the tendency is now to use people across the board rather than to skew things one way or the other. However, it's difficult to avoid skewing, because studies have also shown that people who come along for adoption, when they give a list of the things that they want, they expect in the child that they're going to adopt a higher standard of child than they themselves would be capable of producing. So there's a tension between the two things.
For the Christian, thought of pregnancy comes under the will of God. Therefore, whatever eventuates, whether it be a mongrel, whether it be a perfectly healthy baby, can be under the control of, or is under the control of God for the Christian.
Yes.
I read some time ago where Dr. C. Everett Koop in America, who said that amniocentesis was virtually a seek and destroy mission.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Did you hear the question, or should I repeat it? Didn't need to repeat that one. I would agree with him that it is a search and destroy mission, and I would agree with the that for the Christian couple, they ought to be looking for the will of God. However, I'm aware that when it comes down to it, Christian couples, including ministers, facing the possibility of carrying an abnormal child because there is some added risk factor there, find that difficult to put into practice. While I myself might hold up a certain standard to that person, and I'd like to think that I myself, if faced with that situation, would look at it as being the will of the Lord and that he would provide added grace to meet that situation in the future, there is that problem that we can't medically superimpose that on a person. It's really, they have the ultimate choice and responsibility.
It's the same in the pastoral area, that's why I don't
know. Yes.
You're very slow today. If you are not sure of any area, if there is any term about which you are not clear, ask about it to get further clarity. Or some comment you'd like to make. Yes.
There's been a strong move towards natural contraception recently, and I guess we've come across that quite a lot. Perhaps a lack of success in some areas. What's your comment on that compared to artificial contraception?
my comment on natural contraception, the use of the safe period and such like, compared with artificial methods such as the pill and such like. It seems to me that it's a matter of principle that if contraception is right, well then it's right to use the methods, be they natural or artificial, in the same way that if to increase the productivity of the soil is right, it's right to use fertilizers artificially or to fallow the ground every so often naturally. That either one of them is right, that we live in an unnatural world and we are applying artificial things all the time. That's my whole business, in fact. And anyone who drives a car or uses a tractor or uses a piece of machinery is using unnatural means. So that I myself would see that if someone comes to that decision that contraception is right, then it doesn't matter whether they use the natural or the unnatural means. Now, as far as the natural ones go, the advantage is that they'll be free of side effects. The disadvantage is that the success rate is very much lower than these artificial ones. For example, it has been estimated that if the pill were to be abandoned in the world, the number of abortions performed annually would go up by between 1 and 7 million. That's a statistical prediction. So that I think it's up to the individual. I myself would advise people, unless they feel very strongly committed to natural methods and are prepared to accept the increased risk rate, they ought to use what is offering and be thankful that God has provided that particular method.
Yes.
Doctor, could you tell me how close you'll be in your thinking to some of your more ardent Catholic colleagues?
Thank you. A good question. At the time of the abortion issue, the evangelicals were notorious for their silence at that time. You might remember that there came out a full-page ad in the paper by 171 doctors who were the doctors who respect human life. I was invited to sign with them, but did not do so. I used other means, such as writing to the two ministers involved, and an article that I wrote also appeared in the Brisbane Telegraph at that time that was going on. But my situation is different from the Catholics because they see no difference between intrauterine life and life after birth. From conception to the grave, life is equally sacred, is what they say. I couldn't sign their statement of belief because I myself, as I look at the scriptures, honestly feel that there could well be a difference between intrauterine life and life after birth. My sentiments and my feeling, emotional bias, is towards their Catholic point of view. In the actual working out of a situation, I find that I'm stricter than some of my Catholic colleagues, because they find that they have to depart because of the pressures of the situation from what their theoretical beliefs would be. But in fact, from the theological point of view, I am that different from them.
This may not be quite on the subject, Dr. Thomas, but would you be able to give us, or you can, sure, give us the latest medical opinion on the effect of the pill on the health of the woman who uses it?
Yes, good. Good question. The effect of the pill on the health of the woman. Often we tend to get a slanted view of this because, as we were speaking at lunch, the journalists in the media tend to latch on to sensational bad news. Bad news is of more newsworthy import for them than good news, and so as soon as something comes along that raises a scare about the pill, they're the first to show that. It's a matter of balance with these things. In this life, we get nothing for nothing, and everything we do carries a risk with it. If I walk outside and cross the road, I run the risk in crossing the road of getting run over by a car. And so it's a matter of weighing up the advantages against the disadvantages. If I don't cross the road, the food shop on the other side of the road may mean that it may mean that that's therefore not accessible to me, and I'll die of starvation. So it's a matter of weighing up the advantages against the disadvantages of getting run over. And that's the same with the pill. There are risks with the pill. For example, the risk of dying from heart disease is increased by a factor of 5. Of dying from stroke is increased by a factor of 4. Hypertension is also a risk with it. But it's a matter of weighing that out against the advantages. What needs to be said, for example, in the business of a pulmonary embolism or a clot on the lung, there are risks with the pill, but what we have found is that women, in answer to some of these scares, have gone off the pill, then have had an unwanted pregnancy, and the risk of that same complication causing death in pregnancy is somewhere between the same and double the risk that it is on the pill. So that sometimes people can jump out of the frying pan into the fire. As more sophisticated analytical methods have come along, we've been able to identify more readily which women are at risk. And it's found that in that matter of heart disease, where the risk of death goes up 5 times, that they're very much loaded in the woman who's over the age of 35 and is smoking. And it is rather the smoking which puts her at risk rather than the pill. Once we've excluded those that are at risk, that leaves the average woman round for whom the pill is very safe. The risks of the pill to her health are very, very small compared with the risks of the benefit of unwanted pregnancies. But for that woman who's in the high risk, we need to she ought not to be on the pill. Now, it's a matter of getting perspective on this. If we took 100,000 women who were, say, between the ages of 40 and 44, if that woman, if those women use no contraception, they've got something like a 21 per 1,000 chance of dying from the conception that will come along. If she's not a smoker and on the pill, she's got a 17 per 1,000, per 100,000 chance of dying. Because of pill side effects and also because of pill failures where a pregnancy does come along. If she's in that age group and is a smoker, her risk goes up to 63 per 100,000. It's more than 3 times. So it's a matter of identifying the category that a woman is in before we can answer that question.
Dr. Thomas, I was wondering if you would say some more about insolvent. I
admit it, but I didn't. I think I
didn't hear
you say. Yes, I did beg that. I said I was raising the questions. I myself find it difficult to accept that ensoulment occurs at conception. Obviously, ensoulment has occurred at birth. Also, there are passages of Scripture which indicate that already the Spirit of God is at work, such as when John in his mother's womb leaped for joy when Mary walked in at probably about 4 months or so, and Jeremiah was chosen while he was still in his mother's womb, and Psalm 139, that God's overseen development of the fetus and such like. But when that nephesh, or that living soul, comes into the person is not clear. We just don't know, it seems to me. If someone can discover some new theological principles that will show that, well, that will make things a lot easier for us. But I doubt whether anyone is going to learn that. To me, it seems a gradual process, that ensoulment occurs over the time and certainly is completed by the time that child is born alive. From time to time we have a stillbirth and we've been listening to the baby's heartbeat, and then just say 10 minutes or so before birth it disappears. And it's a very sad sort of thing, We don't sort of feel, well, here's a human being who has died and gone into eternity, but here's a human being who almost made it. And I'm not so sure that even that one, sort of the ensoulment, has not occurred completely. And I was sort of labouring that point a little bit of trying to show that the process of death is not one where there's a sudden cut-off point, but that it's a process, and in the same way I feel that this ensoulment may be a process, which begins not before fertilisation, in the physical sense, though spiritually that person is in God's economy, and the number of his days are already written in God's book, Psalm 139, but it's complete at the time of birth. That's the best I can do.
Doctor, I think the fact that the questions have come fairly slowly, and they have come fairly slowly today, and I'm sorry it's too late now, but they have come fairly slowly, and I think that's an indication that you have raised many questions for us that we haven't considered before. Some of us tend to think some of these areas are fairly black and white, and then when the area is opened up to us, we see that there are so many side issues that we haven't really considered before. And you've introduced us to many of these side issues, and I think we're all saying to ourselves, how further can we enlighten ourselves? Where can we turn now, having our appetite whetted, to material that might help us? Is there any simple medical material that might assist us? Is there anything in the area of theological or biblical writings that might help us? Now, you've done quite a lot of thinking, not only as a doctor, but also as a Christian in this area. Maybe you could just suggest something before we finish.
There's been a real paucity of theological literature on this, and when I began inquiries as much as 4 years ago, I was amazed at how little had been written by people. There's plenty of scope for you folk to get cracking on this sort of thing, and we'll be very grateful for guidance. More recently, some literature is coming out. I myself have found this very helpful, Abortion, the Personal Dilemma, written by R.F.R. Gardner, who is both a practicing obstetrician and an ordained minister, and an evangelical. He was a missionary at the same hospital that I went to in Africa, actually. More recently, there have come out these two books which are available. I think I picked this one up in either the Baptist book, Gospel Book Depot, this one, Cloning, Miracle or Menace, by Lester and Heffley from Sydney. Now, I think that they open up the area quite well. As well as cloning, they deal with these other issues that we've dealt with. Some of it tends to be a little bit unscientific in that they are oversimplifying the issues and bringing emotional overtones, but it still is good. The other one that has come out is one by Gish and Wilson, Clifford Wilson from somewhere in Victoria, which again is, I think, well written. In fact, this one is better written, I'd say, than this one, and he deals with the issues quite well. Manipulating Life, Where Does It Stop? And again, he deals with these issues. This one only came out in about April this year. This one hit the bookshelves, I think, last year. Lester and Heffley, H-E-F-L-E-Y. Now, the committee, Les Sands committee, looking at public issues, has got up some material, and there have been two very good papers written up here in Queensland, one by R. Missenden, a Presbyterian minister, and he looks at it more from the organic point of view. And I think his material is quite good. There's also a good paper being written by Sister Regis Mary of the Catholic Bureau, but nevertheless very good on the matter of genetic engineering. Now, I gather that the Baptist Committee is looking at those papers with a view to putting affirmations, which Bob Missenden has drafted arising out of this, for consideration at the Baptist Assembly. I hope that does happen, because the Presbyterians are addressing themselves to this situation, and I think we do well too. because of the lack of something fairly simple along these lines, there is in publication at present the outline of what I've spoken about today. ANZIA publishers are producing something that I've written along this same line, which will run through somewhat this format today.
Thank you very much, Doctor, and I'm sure we want to express our appreciation to the Doctor for being with us.